Hello, y'all. This is Juliet.
And this is Leisha.
And welcome back to Screen Teen Podcast.
Thank you, everybody who listened to our premiere episode last week. We were super excited. We got some great feedback that we will try to take into account moving forward. We've tried to adjust our volumes, as I know I can be a bit loud. And Chuckles over here can be a bit quiet.
No.
Yes. So we're going to keep taking feedback into account as we move along. We're brand new at all of this. So... this week, we're just going to jump right in after Jules tells us what kind of tea she's sipping on this week.
I have lemon ginger, which is supposed to be good for your belly. And I love it.
I am drinking, because it's 8:30 at night and I need caffeine always, I have myself some black chai tea.
All right.
There we go. New one. This is a black tie affair. This is very fancy. Okay.
You're in your PJs. I'm still in my day clothes.
Shush. Okay. So without further ado, we are going to jump right in and I'm going to let Jules kick us off. What are we talking about this week?
We're talking about Joker, which released last year on October 4th, 2019. It was directed by Todd Phillips, who is known for the movies Old School, Due Date, and the Hangover movies. It was written by Todd Phillips as well, along with Scott Silver, and it is based on characters created by Bob King, Bill Finger, and Jerry Robinson. Scott Silver, other notable film credits are The Fighter, Johns, The Mod Squad, and 8 Mile.
Cool. So I have the fun task of mangling all of these names under production because there were so many hands in the production of this film. All right. So company-wise, we have Warner Brothers Pictures, Village Roadshow Pictures, Braun Studios, aka Braun Creative, Joint Effort, DC Comics, Creative Wealth Media Finance, which was uncredited. And as far as individuals on the production team, Richard Beretta, Bruce German, Jason Clough, Mr. Bradley Cooper. Sorry, I had to say that one fancy because he is the voice of Rocket Raccoon, so I love him forever. sorry. Joseph Garner, Aaron L. Gilbert, Walter Hamada, Anjay Nagpal, Todd Phillips, Emma Tillinger-Koskoff, Michael E. Uslan, and David Webb.
I like learning about some of the people because you get cool names. The DP was Lawrence Shear. He is known for The Hangover 1, 2, and 3, Garden State, Godzilla King of Monsters, and the upcoming Black Adam movie. It was edited by Jeff Groth, who is known for War Dogs, The Wedding Ringer, and Entourage, both the show and the movie. The soundtrack was done by, I should have looked up how to say this. I'm so sorry. I meant to. First name is Hildur, and I don't even.
Oh, Lord. Hildur Guanadatir, something along those lines.
Yeah. She is known for Chernobyl, Sicario, and she was also a cellist on the movie Arrival.
Yeah, we really do need to learn her name because
she's in a bunch of great things.
Worked on some pretty outstanding stuff. All right, so apologies. This is going to be really fun to edit because neither of us can talk tonight. Apologies to her because I probably just mangled her name. So we're going to move on to the cast. And this film, of course, is starring Mr. Joaquin Phoenix as Arthur Fleck, He's known for just a shitload of roles. Namely, we have Her, Gladiator, Walk the Line, and The Master. Following that as Murray Franklin, we have Mr. Robert De Niro, who is known, just a couple of his credits, Raging Bull, Cape Fear, Taxi Driver, of course, and Mean Streets. As Sophie Dumond, we have the lovely Miss Zazie Beetz, who is known for her role in Atlanta, Applesauce, Still Here, and as Domino in Deadpool 2. And I'm super excited to be able to say that playing Penny Fleck, we have Frances Conroy, who is just my older generation lady love, who is known for 6 Feet Under, American Horror Story, Six Souls, and Catwoman.
And then we have Brett Cullen as Thomas Wayne, who is known for Ghost Rider, funnily enough, The Dark Knight Rises, Person of Interest, and True Detective. We have Shay Wingham, who is Detective Burke. He is in Take Shelter, Death Note, Wrist Cutters, A Love Story, and American Hustle. Bill Camp, who is Detective Garrity, 12 Years a Slave, Birdman, Lover and Mercy, and The Outsider TV show. Glenn Fisher, who plays Randall, is in Billions, Barry, True Detective, and Hannibal.
Gordal.
And lastly, we have Lee Gill, who plays Gary. He's in Fantastic Beasts and Where to Find Them, Game of Thrones, and The Scorpion King 4.
Wow. Hold on now. Hold on.
There might be more than four of those.
Oh, God. All right. I need to just lay off that point. Are you going to share your actors now?
Yes. Throughout the movie, I was very curious about Joaquin Phoenix's laugh, and apparently he based his laugh, which he said was the hardest part of the role, on videos of people suffering from pathological laughter. He also sought to portray a character with which audiences could not identify. It was very uncomfortable for him to practice in front of people. He even asked Todd Phillips to come to his audition of the laugh, just to make sure that it was right and that it worked. And he is quoted multiple times just saying it was the most uncomfortable thing. It was the worst experience.
I mean, it was the most uncomfortable thing to watch in the best way possible. So, I mean, I'm not surprised. All right. So the budget for Joker was $62.5 million. As of right now, it is the seventh highest grossing film of 2019. And the highest R-rated...
It's the highest grossing R-rated movie of all time.
Is it really the seventh grossing, highest grossing film of 2019?
That's what I read.
There are that many movies over $1 billion?
Huh. I mean, it was a big year for Marvel last year.
Okay. Okay. So it earned $1.071 billion on that $62.5 million budget. As far as reception, it's really kind of almost a balanced playing field. As far as critics, Rotten Tomatoes, it's sitting at a 68%. Metacritic, which is always a little tougher, is sitting at a 59 out of 100. Now, the audience reviews tell a little bit of a different story. The aggregated Rotten Tomatoes audience review has it at an 88. And IMDb has it at an 8.6 out of 10.
So fans seem to really like it.
Right.
The movie has a runtime of 2 hours and 2 minutes, which equals 122 minutes. The sound mix is Dolby Atmos. They had two different aspect ratios, which is appropriate given the times for the movie itself, and then the live TV footage with Murray Franklin. The cameras that they used were all Arri Alexa cameras, Arri Alexa 65, Arri Alexa LF, and the Arri Alexa Mini, which if I could afford a cinematography camera, I would get a Mini. They all used Hasselblad Prime DNA lenses. And that's about it.
All right. So with all of the beautiful stats done and over with, we're going to kind of move into our own personal notes. Prior to this weekend, we had not actually seen Joker. So we have gotten into the groove of watching the movie we're going to review twice, back-to-back nights. And so the first viewing that we did to prepare for this podcast episode was our first viewing ever. So we were late to the party, which tends to happen when you have children. Prevents you kind of from getting to the theater sometimes. So
Most of the time,
yes. Very, very special occasions when we can make it to the movie theater.
I.e. Marvel movies.
Yeah. So, all right, we're going to move in to kind of our thoughts on the film by starting about talking about Todd Phillips' direction. And I'm going to kind of start it off by saying what's almost my entire interpretation of the movie, which is I'll forever be trying to figure out what kind of film he was trying to make with this.
Yeah.
And I think it's because I'm so used to him being in more of a straightforward comedic genre. When I think of Todd Phillips, I think of Due Date, which I know other folks will think of other things first because he's more well known for some other things. But Due Date had RDJ, so that's where my mind goes when I think of Todd Phillips. That movie kind of sticks out. There was a hint of darkness here and there, like dark humor. There was some grief and loss in the movie. It's not as though directors can't be very accomplished in multiple different genres, but I just couldn't get it out of my mind that this didn't feel like a Todd Phillips film, and that kind of begged the question that maybe this was the pinnacle of a Phillips film and the others weren't quite so genuine, or maybe they were all genuine and it's just two very distinct aspects of the director himself.
I hate The Hangover. I've not seen Due Date, so I have no point of reference for his directorial style.
And you hate Will Ferrell movies, like 90% of Will Ferrell movies.
Yeah,
so
I do like
school.
Will Ferrell, like Stranger Than Fiction. But yeah, I loved a lot of what he did with this movie in terms of like figuring out the color palette. And it's really hard to know what's real or not. And that kind of also flows into editing and cinematography. Mm-hmm. Everything in this movie is some sort of reflection of Arthur's mindset. So you can kind of, the audience kind of gets to feel how he's feeling, I think, to a degree. And that's not always easy to accomplish, I feel.
Mm-hmm.
So.
I mean, yeah, it was not only that he has this questioning reality, which is a nice, just kind of a nice experience overall, but it was such a slow burning buildup. It's kind of like a constant crescendo, which however he managed to kind of wrangle the cast that he did and develop the dynamics that he did, regardless of some pacing choices that I question, I think just that slow burning up to that crescendo really shows off his brilliance in the film that he wanted to make. He seems to me like a filmmaker who doesn't really care about overall critical reception, which is just me kind of reading into his films. He seems to enjoy the films that he makes. From what I've read, he had a vision for this film and he stuck to it. So the tone holds firm.
Mm-hmm.
In a way, there's no punches pulled from the discomfort that we're supposed to feel. You know, Todd Phillips didn't say, oh, I'm going to make a superhero movie or I'm going to make a supervillain movie in the realm of what we're used to seeing a superhero / villain movie being made. So just hats off to him for seeing his vision through and really turning it into an unprecedented and surprising success that it was.
Yeah, I don't have much more to say. That you kind of hit everything on the head.
Sure. What'd you think of the writing and the characters?
First off, I don't know if he was just trying to drive whatever point he was trying to drive home, but I didn't understand why literally everyone, for no reason, was just so bad to him. Like, I get that that's a point. He's trying to make a point, but, like, your point doesn't make sense.
Well, and that's kind of, we were questioning whether or not, because you're right, everyone that he comes into contact with exception, I mean, there are a few exceptions. You know, his social worker in the beginning of the film, his social worker at the end of the film, we don't see them being cruel to him.
No, but he definitely dislikes his beginning social worker. Sure. And gets pissed off. He's like, are you even listening to me? You don't listen to me.
Right. Well, I think that it was hard for him to process that she was allowing him the space. You know, she didn't jump on him after that. And also, Sophie, his neighbor, he built the relationship up in his head that obviously wasn't there, but she wasn't cruel to him at any point.
No. So, all women of color.
All women of color. Yes, and we'll talk on that a little bit more. But otherwise, I completely agree with you. You know, we see him being attacked by this group of kids mm-hmm. who steal his sign.
For no reason. For no good reason other than they're dumb kids.
For no good reason. I mean, I actually have here in my notes, why is everyone so goddamn mean to him?
Yeah.
He must attract every terrible asshole in Gotham. You've got the three guys that he kills on the train. You know, did they deserve death? Probably not. It's not
even like he's doing anything. He's just a weirdo. I'm a weirdo. Yeah, I got bullied, but meh.
But not by everyone.
No.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. Is your point. And there were just some things that made me question whether or not these engagements were actually happening the way that we were seeing them.
I had that thought too.
Yeah?
If he was, you know, if it was just like a mild encounter, but whatever mind state he was in just exacerbated the situation.
There's just, the one thing that I really... Oh, I don't know. So watching this film, you would think that anyone who has an obvious neurological or mental health disorder would be just completely ostracized to death. Like, mm-hmm. that's the feeling that you get, which, are they ostracized? They can be, especially if it's something evident. But as hard as Arthur is, I don't know. That's, you make a very valid point there. I'm still shocked that Thomas Wayne just punched him in the fucking face.
Because that probably did happen. It probably wasn't in his head in any capacity.
And that to me is like really extreme. Like,
yeah, it seems like characters just, there's not a lot of rhyme or reason to what they do. Like Bruce just lets this complete stranger stick his fingers in his mouth and it made him smile.
Who does that?
Like it was nothing. Like my our toddler wouldn't let you do that without putting up a fight.
Right.
Like,
I think there's one of the only interactions that he had where I'm like, yes, people would treat you this way is with Alfred, actually.
Oh, yeah.
Because Alfred's like, you know, walks up when he has his hands in Bruce's mouth, whether or not he can see it. And he's handed this stranger that's handed him these flowers. And Alfred tries to do him a quote unquote kindness by saying, you know, there nothing actually happened between your mom and Thomas Wayne, which we'll definitely get into here in a little bit as to whether or not we think they did. But, you know, Alfred told him to leave and get out, but he wasn't cruel to him. He responded like a human being would respond in that situation, I feel.
Didn't Alfred do the same thing as Thomas and kind of poke fun at his mom, though? Like, he, that's like a sensitive sore spot.
I mean, he said, you know, to a sense, like, she's crazy.
Yeah, and Thomas did the same thing.
Right.
Which, I mean, I would guess your average person would do something along those lines, but he wasn't outright cruel.
Right. Yes, yeah. He kept the fence between them. Arthur was actually the one to reach through and enact mm-hmm. and engage in violent aggression towards Alfred. But I'm watching this like, oh yeah, Alfred's one of the very few people, Alfred, Sophie, who act like I think a typical person would act. Mm-hmm. But
the unrest that kind of that Arthur is the catalyst for is mentioned before anything even hits the fan. Like he, when he's talking to his social worker, he's like, is it just me or is it getting crazier out there? And she's just like, it certainly is tense.
Right.
So it's like, I wonder if things would have escalated with or without him.
That's a good point. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Like it just seems Like, Gotham is just a shitty place to live.
I mean.
Oh, is that weird? What was the weird subplot that they tried to do with the super rats?
With the giant rats?
Yeah, like, I don't know if they popped up more than I noticed or not, but, like, why? Is there a villain? Is there a villain I'm not aware of that has something to do with rats?
Maybe. I mean, you're talking to me. My DC knowledge is, like, yeah, as limited as my knowledge of, you know, calculus. I have no idea.
I just didn't, get why they were trying to...
But I don't know if maybe that was just kind of one of those underhanded indications that you're watching a movie that takes place in a somewhat fantastical universe. That takes place in, like, a universe where superheroes and supervillains exist. Because that does sound like, you know, something that could potentially happen in a superhero movie.
I guess, but this is DC's Joker that isn't DC's Joker.
Sure, yeah.
So I don't know.
Maybe it was just one of those things that they interjected here and there, like his interaction with Bruce or like the very end with Bruce's parents getting killed, things like that. To remind you that this is a previously established character being in the his story is being told in a completely new way this time around.
Yeah, his origin.
Right. As far as the writing, you already pointed out just kind of what to me was the most brilliant aspect of the whole thing was that we were left to wonder about the validity of reality during the entire film.
Oh, it was so good. I remember watching. I think we kind of figured it out, and I don't know how much Phillips wanted you to be able to figure it out or not, but we were definitely questioning whether or not, like, his relationship with Sophie was real or not. Like, we kind of started questioning various bits of his reality.
Right.
And, like, on the second time around, we were more confident in, like, looking at other things and kind of, I think, noticing other things that weren't necessarily real or noticing certain cues as to indicate what state of mind he might be in.
Sure. I think one of my favorite things about the experience of watching this is one of the only films where I was less certain about everything the second time around. Because I watched it the first time and we were questioning whether that relationship was real, but then watching it again, I was like, is any of this actually happening?
Right. A weird thought that's popped up a couple times since starting this podcast is Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind has popped into my head, so I don't know if that was any sort of inspiration in the back of their minds or not, just kind of the altered reality and not quite, you know, is this real or is this made up or blah 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 blah.
Right.
You made the comment about during our second viewing of why is the violence so disjointed, and it really kind of is. They're Joaquin and Phillips are quoted saying they wanted it to feel as real as possible, but I was like, this doesn't feel that real, especially with the abuse that he suffers by everyone almost. So I don't know.
Yeah, I don't know. The violence throughout the film was interesting. And it kind of fits in with my point that we'll get to later. I know I keep saying that, but there's so much to be said about this movie. I think it ties in the fact that a central aspect of this character doesn't make any fucking sense. And that's just his psychopathy, like his mental state. And this might just be me getting on my therapist high horse or what have you. But, you know, he's probably because of the abuse that he suffered as a child and the abuse that he continues to suffer in his adulthood, definitely some PTSD in there, maybe a little bit of Tourette's as indicated by the laughter, or it's a neurobiological condition or a TBI, a traumatic brain injury, or another neurological dysfunction from the head injury that he got as a child. Depression, psychosis. So what I kept thinking was it's like somebody ripped pages out of the DSM, wallpapered a room, spun around a few times, blindfolded, just pitching darts. And they were like, oh, yeah, this symptom. Oh, yeah, this symptom.
Yeah, that was a big complaint of viewers, yeah. Especially throughout the second viewing.
Well, if you're looking at a film that is trying to have this underlying plot of looking at mental health and the way that those who struggle with mental health are treated. I mean, Phillips even kind of went on record as to state that they didn't identify a certain diagnosis. They were very vague with it intentionally. And I think that's, I wouldn't necessarily say it's cheap, but to me.
I was just about to say lazy.
Lazy. Yeah. Well, it just takes the authenticity out of it for me. Not the lack of a specific diagnosis, but just this huge, broad, like, maelstrom of random symptoms all mashed together in one person. When in reality, like I said, he's got some PTSD. I think he has a traumatic brain injury, and he's a fucking sociopath.
They had an idea, and picking something specific wouldn't fit in, is what it seems like. They had a vision, and they did what they could to make their vision come true.
Yeah.
I feel like he tries to foreshadow a bit, and it doesn't always land. But one instance of where it could land is Penny Fleck, his mother, alludes to her heart attack when the two of them are having an argument. And then, like, when the detectives show up, she is in the hospital. She is going to the hospital because of a stroke.
Right. Yeah. I mean, there's her. We learn a lot about her, too, and her diagnosis and her psychopathy, and which seems to make sense because we know that a lot of mental health issues are genetic, but then they throw in, but he's adopted, and there's a lot in regards to mental health and his relationship with mom that doesn't make sense and doesn't sit with me well, talking about him specifically.
I mean, we're supposed to kind of question the adoption. I know. Because there's the question of paternity that people are debating, which I don't think he's Thomas Wayne's kid.
Really?
Yeah, I don't.
I think I land on the other end of the spectrum there. I think that he is.
I think Thomas Wayne flirted. It might have gone a little farther than that, but he's a married, wealthy, famous man, and those people can't have scandals. So he buried it once her color showed.
Well, I essentially... So I read a really good article on Polygon.com. It was written by Karen Hahn, and we'll make sure to link it in the show notes. And it's talking about how the question of paternity is one of the biggest failures of the film.
Mm-hmm.
Because honestly, when I watch it, I think of, you mentioned, you know, this is someone high in society. This is someone who's wealthy. And you're right. He can't be known to have a scandal. So if he knocks Penny Fleck up, then he has the resources to forge, you know, to forge adoption papers. He has resources to essentially gaslight her into, if she already has unstable mental health, is this someone gaslighting somebody of lower mental health and socioeconomic status than him? But really, it boils down to when it comes down to it in the end, does his paternity actually matter? Do we even know if Arthur believes that he is Thomas Wayne's kid or not?
He seems like he does in the bathroom scene. But yeah. I don't know if that belief is shaken.
Right.
Shaken.
Shooketh. Shooketh. That belief has been shooketh. So it seems kind of sloppy to let a couple of these questions go on open-ended, as it mentions in that article. So I'm going to quote this. Karen Hahn says, so maybe the Joker is Bruce Wayne's brother. That such a detail is left unclear might be fine were Arthur only a part of a greater whole, but he's front and center here. There's little room for such half measures, and if the film doesn't ultimately care, then why should we? And that's kind of how I felt.
It's a little how I felt about the whole thing, to be honest. Like, don't get me wrong, I enjoyed it from like a filmmaker perspective because sure. there's a lot of awesome visual storytelling happening, but like, you know, you get past that false ending and you get to the real ending, and yeah. I'm just like, oh, all right, I don't care anymore, because it feels like we've got a bunch of things that have been tacked on.
Sure.
It seems not necessarily half-assed, but like, what happened?
Yeah, what happened? And I think that there was another scene in the film that you and I interpreted very differently.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
So much so that when I turned to you and asked what your thoughts were on it, it had just then occurred to me that maybe my opinion on what happened wasn't everybody's, because it seemed so clearly spelled out.
Mm.
And then when I asked you and you had the opposite viewpoint, I was like, oh, shit. This is interesting, and turns out that this is also a debate, probably second only to his parentage. And this is whether or not Arthur killed Sophie
mm-hmm.
after she discovers him having essentially broken into her apartment in a state of psychosis. Do you want to explain your stance and what made you think?
You know me, I am very much a gut feeling person. And when you asked me, I don't know if I had actually really thought about it, but when you asked me, I was like, oh, yeah, he totally left her alone and just, like, left.
Hmm.
And it didn't occur to me that he might have killed her.
Yeah.
Because you have no indication either way, but, like, at the end, he's very clearly killed his, or injured at the very least, his therapist, because there's blood on coming off his shoes.
Right.
So, I don't know.
Yeah, and to me, I'm watching it, and we don't see what happens. We see him leave. We see him leave the door open. And not only that, but sometime later, we see he's sitting down. He's laughing maniacally in his apartment, which means that he's very – it was his distressed laughter.
Mm-hmm.
So, he's very distressed about something and distraught. And then we see ambulance lights outside. So in my head, I'm like, oh, yeah, I mean, he fucking destroyed her, left the door open, somebody came across them and called 911, mm-hmm. called the ambulance, something like that. Because, I mean, she is never seen again in the film.
Oh, yeah. I mean, those are valid points and reasons. He could also have just maybe perhaps being distressed about, oh, realizing that this wasn't real.
Sure.
I mean, you got... The crappy thing about it is if Phillips did all of these things on purpose for the purpose of, like, debating.
Yeah.
Seems lame. Like.
It's very much, you know, did the top topple over at the end of Inception?
Right. Yeah, exactly.
And ultimately, does it play into the bigger story and doesn't matter?
Especially since this movie's standalone. Although apparently there's rumors, even though Phillips said no, about a sequel.
Right. I don't know. Yeah. There's just a lot about the writing of this film. We've just now finished discussing just the writing mm-hmm. aspect. A lot of story that's wonderful and very problematic at the same time.
Just like Arthur,
yes. Really, I've said a lot that I wanted to say about Arthur. I'm going to make, like, 2 points and then let you take over as far as mentioning anything else about characters. I have a couple notes here and there about others.
I'm probably just going to play off of you because mine were very, like, concise to what I've already said.
Okay.
Miss Character Development Woman.
So I just wanted to start kind of by, it's all in caps here, by screaming that Arthur Fleck makes me think so much of Buffalo Bill Aww. From Silence of the Lambs. Mm-hmm. And I don't know if it was intentional. I really kind of hope it was. But if not, that's also kind of a gem. Just the dancing, the way he moved, the speaking to himself, you know, him saying, you're such a good dancer, makes me think of Buffalo Bill, you know, would you fuck me? I'd fuck me. Like, I could hear that over and over in my head. The transformation from being one being into another being via the use of violence against others, even that concept is very similar, which strengthens the only other point that I have about Arthur, in that from a clinical mind, he is a sociopath.
Mm-hmm.
He's a serial killer. I mean, yes, they, depending on what comics you've read, what movies you've seen, is he a crime lord? Is he a menace? Is he X, Y, and Z, depending on what Joker you're getting?
Is he just an agent of chaos?
Exactly. Yeah. In this film, Arthur Fleck is a downright serial killer.
Mm-hmm.
And I just feel like it's, I feel almost compelled to have to say that, you know, everything that he does makes some kind of sense through the lens of trauma, as a trauma reaction, except for murder. You know, sorry. Trauma is not the source of mass murder.
No.
There are plenty of people with mental health issues who don't go out and fucking kill people. And just, I need to say, it comes up so much in debates about gun violence and gun safety and just blah, 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 a lot of political debates. But people who have mental illnesses are far more likely to be victims of violent crimes as opposed to the ones who commit them.
Mm-hmm.
And I just think that's really important to say. Now, are there killers who have these kind of mental illnesses? Of course there are. But just, it almost seemed irresponsible. Like, we want to build empathy for this character who struggles from the world being shitty and struggles from mental health. But at the same time, it's irresponsible to paint the picture that his actions are to blame on mental health and those around him. He's only responsible for his own actions, just like all of us are.
I'm pretty sure, I forget her name, oh no, Zazie Beetz?
Yeah.
Was interviewed and she was asked, you know, are we supposed to feel sympathetic towards Arthur? Are we supposed to feel for him? And she was like, no, not really him, but like the idea of isolation and how people with, you know, mental illness or whatever are isolated, or individuals who are isolated need help.
Sure. Yeah.
Which was a great point from her.
Absolutely.
And, you know, we aren't necessarily supposed to feel for this particular individual, but like the circumstance yes. that he is in.
And I see that. And that's kind of why I'm confused. And it goes back to the very first question I had is, what really is Todd Phillips' message? What Joker is this?
Yeah. It's also weird that, you know, once the Joker is more or less fully realized within Arthur, that he becomes very feminine.
Kind of, yeah.
Very feminine and kind of wily and playful in a really creepy way.
Yeah.
It's an interesting... Especially since all of the people that were trying to help him
mm-hmm.
were women.
Were women of color, yes.
Well, I mean, I feel like his mom also tried to help him, but she's not able to in any capacity.
Right. Well, and I almost wonder if there wasn't some, like, Munchausen by proxy happening. Mm. Because when he loses his mental health coverage, which is a thing that happened.
Oh, yeah.
In the early 80s, in the 90s, it still happens today. You know, they cut the funding to community mental health for him. He loses his therapy and his meds. But when he loses his meds, sure, he slips further into psychopathy, but he also becomes a more snappy dresser. He also becomes a more dancer. Fluid mover. Yeah. Yes, like he almost seems like he's able to function a little more clearly, mental state aside, if that makes any kind of sense. Like he almost takes care of himself a little bit better.
Mm-hmm.
And that raises the question of, was he drugged because he has antisocial personality disorder and they're trying to, you know, drug him to keep him from being a danger to others? Was he on 7 different meds, which in the 80s, those would have been like first generation antipsychotic medications? You know, if he was on 7 of them, he would probably be in a chair drooling all the time. That's just another me nitpicking about depiction of mental health accuracy in a film about a comic book villain, and I need to knock that shit off. But
I mean, it's part of the point that he's trying to make, so your perspective on this I think is key. It's sure. pretty key to A, why like the writing is problematic, and B, you know, how things have happened and
right.
why they've happened, or, you know, how they could have happened or should have happened.
Yeah.
If that makes sense.
Yeah. I mean, I feel for Penny. I really do. She's obviously mentally ill. You know that without even being told. we can question her mental health status as well. Like I said earlier, is she crazy? Did she create this delusion of having Thomas's love child? Or was this that example of kind of manipulating the lower class and mentally unwell into craziness? Did she have kind of a Munchausen disorder? Did she make Arthur seem more crazy than he really was to become over-medicated, to become overly dependent, X, Y, and Z? So basically, there's some kind of neurological dysfunction happening with him, given the card that he has, and the abuse and head trauma experienced as a child. But just to sum up Arthur Fleck, in my opinion, from a clinical mind, this movie's a goddamn mess. I'll just kind of leave it at right there. Other characters. What are some notes you have about some of the other characters that aren't Arthur?
I don't really have a whole lot. Because Joaquin Phoenix is so front and center. Yeah. Everybody's just playing with him. I think everybody did a really good job.
Oh, sure.
I think I mentioned this. I feel like having Robert De Niro and Zazie Beetz was kind of wasted.
Yeah.
Like, I don't feel like you needed these big names. She might not be as big, but, I mean, she's coming up. Good for her. In these roles, like, you had Joaquin in the titular role carry the whole movie regardless of them. And you don't even... They play crucial parts, but it's... Their celebrity, their star status was whatever. I don't know. I'm always weird about that.
Yeah, like I feel like you are.
You got these big names and you're paying them the big bucks potentially for these whatever roles.
Well, I mean, star power plays into getting asses and seats at the movie theater.
This is true.
And they did really...
Anti-corporate.
I know. But they did do really well.
Yeah, well, of course they did.
And they were enjoyable. Like, you mentioned De Niro. In the character that he plays is just a goddamn douche canoe. In all reality, he is. You know, does he deserve to die? No. Being an asshole doesn't mean you deserve to be shot in the face. But... why does he have to be cruel? Initially, he starts off as cruel, showing off Arthur's videos from his failed stand-up attempt. Why make fun of someone trying to be funny, trying to break into a difficult business, and then to bring them onto the show to kind of feed off of that failure? You know, it makes me feel gross. Mm-hmm. Like, his character makes me feel gross and sad. And that's also a play on, I feel for Arthur here.
You feel for him and then you don't because he kills somebody.
That's true. I mean, he's killed multiple people at this point. And also you mentioned the therapist. I have such conflicting feelings about his initial social worker, who was just this little bit role, and I will not ramble on and on and on. My initial watch was, you know, she's a piece of shit therapist. But then I kind of put more thought into it. She doesn't complete a safety check, even looking at some of the really sincerely disturbing things in his notebook. Like, she's not judgmental about the, you know, the pictures cut out of porn mags, because that's whatever. I like that she wasn't judgmental about that, but she comes off as judgmental. Like, bro, you're on 7 meds. They've got to be doing something when he's saying they're not. Like, I need my meds up. I don't want to feel like this anymore. And she's just like, well, your meds got to be doing something. So.
Yeah, and I don't know if that's a writing thing or, like, them with their vision and trying to, like, fit everything into their idea that they want to show.
Right.
Or if they actually put thought into how, you know, therapists actually work. Or, you know, she works for the city,
yeah,
and for a program that's about to get cut. Like, how much is she getting paid? How much?
But to be fair, when you're in a helping profession, affect your care.
But again, Gotham sucks.
Gotham
so,
does fucking suck.
You know.
But I like she doesn't. She lets him go off on her. She gives him the space to do that. And she relates to him. And that, you know, she's like, basically, they don't give a fuck about you. And they don't give a fuck about people like me either.
Yeah.
And there is where I'm like, okay, whether or not he realizes that you are relating to him, whether or not he's capable
that's
to
also,
understand.
Yeah, his issue is that, and you made this point when we were watching the second time, is he is unaware of, like, the minorities and the others suffering around him.
Right.
He is a privileged-ish white dude. He's not privileged.
Well, but he's privileged because he's white. Yeah. Like, he has white privilege, which... Anybody listening right now, if you don't know the definition of what white privilege is, I'm not going to sit here and explain it to you. You can do some Googling. But it doesn't mean that you're well off just because you're white.
Yes.
It just means that the color of your skin has never stood in your way.
Yes. But yeah, you know, there's other people suffering around him. There is the unrest that he mentions,
right,
that they talk about. There is already, like, rioting in the streets and people being upset about, you know, Thomas Wayne being the...
Right.
Becoming potentially, he's running for mayor, excuse me, and people are upset about that because it's a rich dude and there's, like, you know, like, the class wars and, yeah.
Which, kudos to this film and to, like, you know, kudos to Phillips for making a film that can, that even though it's set in the early 80s, continues to be relevant.
Oh, yeah.
To society and political unrest.
I mean, this movie does a lot of things well.
Sure,
it just bungles it in a couple spots.
Right. I also feel like, I don't have this in my notes until later, but this feels like an appropriate time to just say that there's no part of me that exists that thinks that Todd Phillips made a film to cater to, like, white supremacists or the incel community.
No.
But I can see why.
It wasn't the intent.
Right.
And they definitely... found things very easily to latch onto.
Absolutely. They found a way to make it resonate with them.
Yes.
You know, the fact that he does, as a white male, feel like he's being victimized, he's everywhere powerless. He turns, when in reality he is in that situation. But, you know, he also kills at least one woman of color trying to help him, probably two women of color. You know, it's just, there's that aspect to it. And there's that kind of incel frame of thought of, I deserve whatever I want. And society doesn't give it to me. So I am going to take it.
That's a huge line, a huge word. And, like, the climax of this film, too, is you get what you fucking deserve.
Yeah.
Not quite in the same sense, but.
That's true.
Mm-hmm.
And I told you how much it bothered me about Arthur also. Is, I mean, he doesn't rape anyone that we see, but he has some sexually aggressive moments.
Mm-hmm.
Even in his fantasy with Sophie, he knocks on the apartment, goes right in, doesn't say a word, doesn't ask for consent, grabs her face, kisses her. In his fantasy, she's receptive, whatever. In reality, as we see it, when he goes onto the talk show, he does the same thing to the female guest.
I feel like that's also what he does with Sophie in his fantasy is, like, oh, romanticized the action in a lot of, like, rom-coms, and so it's, like, a cultural thing, unfortunately. So it's like, you know, I've seen this is how it should play out, I'm gonna be this hero, I don't know if that's the right word, and kind of, like, come in and impress this woman. I don't know,
it made me feel ooky.
Like, it happens in other movies, it happens in our media, like,
you're right. I think there's a slow shift to change that, but you're absolutely right. It does.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Good Lord. Please take over for a little bit and tell me some of your thoughts about production design.
Oh my God, the color. Oh my God, I was having a fit with the color in a good way the first watch. And then I just wouldn't let anything go during the second watch.
Right.
Because everything starts out so blue and yellow contrast, and what do you get when you mix those two colors together? You get green. Whose signature color is green? The Joker. So it's, and I was trying to figure out what Todd was trying to do with the color, and it's not just the lighting, it's his clothing, it's the environment, the background, and it's in, you get the shift when he starts to change and become the Joker. You're starting to get greens, you're starting to get a gradient from the yellow into the green into the blue, and the kind of the cinematography is like he'll be centered in the green with the two colors on the side of him. So I don't know if it was trying to, like, show the conflict within Arthur and things like that. And then, like, when he kills the dudes on the subway, it's his, like, first kills, you get that bright orange.
A really violent orange color.
Really vibrant red orange, which at the end of the movie is the color of his suit. So you get the green and you get that orange. And it's just so nice.
It is so nice. And not only that, but you mentioned, okay, so we're blending cinematography and production because it is what happens. So let's just continue to blend. You were the one that pointed out the orange being consistent with the violent scenes. And just I have chills thinking about it. Not only the suit, but at the end, Gotham's literally on fire.
Yeah, it's
engulfed in flame and like you said, just like bathed in this. Great. Perfect time to have a hiccup is when recording a podcast. I would say edit it out, but let's leave it in. That was fun.
Is that just going to happen every time? Probably. You got hiccups last time.
Like, are you awake now?
You're just so excited.
I am. I'm so excited that I like fuck up breathing. But yeah, it's just a really nice visual representation of what's happening, that with that orange. I love the orange.
And something that I wish I would have paid a little more attention to, I might have to like go back and scrub through, but I believe, and somebody can like comment if I'm wrong, is that a lot of the women, all of the women he encounter have some sort of like pink or peach light orangey color associated with them.
Interesting.
I know when Sophie finds him in his apartment, she's wearing, I believe, black and white, but the walls might be orange, so maybe that could indicate his actions toward her.
I say if she did.
Maybe. But it's just, color is so important in this, and I've never paid more attention / had it more in my face, I feel, with a color palette like this. And production did great. Cinematography did great.
Right.
Todd, this was just like a highlight of your film. Another neat thing about movies is, you know, there's so many CGI elements, especially with comic movies. This had little to no CGI effects. Like, the most obvious one is the exterior of Arkham Asylum.
Mm-hmm.
But they did their best in order to, like, keep their budget low, having very, very few CGI effects. So everything was practical effects are done in camera, which is a testament to your cinematographer.
Absolutely.
And your crew, your camera crew.
Just the art of filmmaking.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. As you know, before we had CGI effects, people were having to, like, figure all of these things out.
Right.
It's, you know, like, I'm pretty sure Aliens is well known for a lot of their practical effects and in-camera effects. Like, you know, going back to, like, movies like that.
I'm thinking about, like, the original Jurassic Park.
Yeah, animatronics.
Yeah, absolutely.
Let's build this giant robot T-Rex.
A couple things that I have. I'm not going to touch a lot on color because you really hit it with that. Two notes here that I have for cinematography and production design. There's a fairly consistent aspect of something standing in the way and kind of separating Arthur from the rest of the world, that I really love that. So when he was spying on Sophie through the schoolyard fence, you know, there was that separation. When he got fired, he was in a payphone booth, which literally he's separated from the person making this huge life decision and that they're not even in the same space. And he's also just kind of literally boxed in, and that's a nice visual. When he's interacting with Bruce and Alfred, it's through a wrought iron gate. When he's talking to the clerk at Arkham Asylum, it's through that security window. So all of the designs and the sets creating these visual barriers are very striking because, as we know, he can't quite get through. He can't quite make the connections that he so desperately seems to want to make. And something about just the setting design and production design cinematography of that barrier just really spoke to me a lot.
I mean, that's the DP working with production to get those shots, to tell that visual story, to get that visual element and, you know, what you all said about the barriers and not being able to connect.
Right.
So.
the effects team. I'll play off what you said, and just I love them, especially because of the brutality and the violence. Mm-hmm. If people are going to be listening consistently, I love me some well done gore and violence mm-hmm. in movies, as long as it makes sense. It simmers. It's a simmering film, and it doesn't boil over with like the grand scale PG-13 superhero Marvel movie violence of punching robots and, you know, gods of mischief in the face, et cetera, et cetera. But instead we get this like explosion of blood and viscera splatters and the stark contrast of the red against white, especially on his face. Mm-hmm. Towards the end when he kills, Randall, yeah, when he kills Randall in such a random and violent attack, just the contrasting colors and the violence is kind of an in-your-face testament to not pulling punches. And this is not a PG-13. Once again, this is not a superhero film. Mm-hmm. This is not going to be Loki on Disney Plus exploring villains. This is like... just the starkness of that is, no, we're going to show you blood and we're going to show you what happens when you stab someone.
Yeah, I mean, despite his, like, violent acts feeling a little disjointed, it's well done.
Yeah, exactly. And then I loved what I noticed, and it might have been intentional, it might not have been. I would say that it probably was. Everything done with the stairs.
Oh, yeah, I didn't even... realize that, but that's, you know, that's another production with cinematography and right. editing playing together.
Yeah,
but it's a conscious choice that the director and DP made,
sure,
and then brought in production.
I mean, it had to have been, it couldn't have been accidental, because so like we get the shot near the beginning, it's twilight, it's getting dark, it's been a long ass day, we see Arthur kind of trudging up the long staircase, and you think about, at least I was thinking about, how far he must travel, how high he has to climb, and not just, you know, in reality, but just kind of symbolically, mm-hmm. every day, just to function, everything's an uphill battle from the bottom, having to climb up, and then at the end, even though he's having kind of the fall from grace and fall from humanity as he develops into Joker, he's giving in to his desires without fighting. He's not fighting anything anymore. And we see him coming down that same staircase, and it's daytime. Everything's vibrant, colorful, bright. He's dancing. It's wonderful. Mm-hmm. Just that juxtaposition.
Yeah, yeah.
The symbolism of the climb versus the fall and what it mm-hmm. looks like on him is chilling to me, and I love it.
That's pretty much all I have about production design.
Right. I will say one thing about editing, and that is that it's my sincerely held belief that if I don't notice bad edits or choppy edits, then the editing for a film is generally well done. I didn't have anything really specific for edits in this movie. You know, some movies focus and really utilize editing tactics for storytelling. I'm sure there was a shitload of it in this film, too. It just didn't occur to me. But I didn't notice anything blatantly like, whoa, that cut just took me out of the film, or whoa, that transition was a total mess. So in my book, that, you know, is job well done.
Yeah, the editing seems to focus on reactions, and most of the time on Arthur's reaction, so it'll be a really long cut, and I have one in my mind. I don't even, it's when he's talking to Murray Franklin,
yeah,
and it's basically the whole "you're awful" dialogue.
Oh yeah, yeah.
And it's literally really tight on his face, and they just hold it while the two are having a conversation, because oftentimes when two characters or multiple characters are conversing, you kind of cut between them and you kind of overlap who's talking with who's not talking and the shots that you're getting, but it just holds on him and you're just watching his hurt, pissed off face.
Right.
And that happens a lot in this film. A lot of just watching Arthur react to what's happening. And then on other spots, like the first conversation with the first social worker, it, you know, is cutting between them conversing, but it also will cut to like little details, like she pulls out something to do with his medicine. It's the details of specific pages in his book. Right. And it's just, it gives you glimpses and it gives you really quick cuts. Like there's the one when they mention that Arthur was in the mental hospital, and it's just a really nice shot and it's framed very well. It's that rule of thirds again. And he's also framed within the door, which helps give the audience a sense of being trapped. And he just like hits the door once or twice with his head and then it cuts away.
Yes, that was brilliant.
And there's little, that's sprinkled throughout. So it's the editing is kind of subtle in that, because it does have a lot of the long kind of cuts here and there, and then kind of is what is average the rest of the time. You've got all the shots, the really long shots on the stairwell, which are kind of broken up, but it's still the same area. But yeah.
Yeah. I completely forgot about that. Kind of the head hitting the door. That was really well. I remember just being like, oh shit.
Something I really enjoyed was there's a lot of shots specifically when there is that barrier between him and somebody else, where it's very, the depth of field is very shallow. And what I mean by that, for those of you that don't know, your depth of field is how much something is in focus. So like your standard shot, you may have the character in focus, but their background is a little blurry. A very shallow depth of field. And in this instance is when he's trying to get the records about his mom from Arkham Asylum, you literally can only see his one eyeball, not both eyeballs,
right.
But one eyeball, and everything else is out of focus. And like, you're literally focusing on him. And that happens a lot. And I really enjoyed it. You are often in people's space. The DP, really like to have really tight framing. So it was like very tight on people's faces. I felt personally very into like people's personal space, especially with Arthur, because you really, this movie tried so hard to get you to like feel what he was feeling almost.
Right.
Another interesting thing was a lot of unsteady shots, which I think is another reflection of Arthur's state of mind. So it's either, I imagine that they had like a steady cam sort of deal and were following Arthur around, or very potentially they could have just taken the camera like off of the tripod or whatever stand that they had and literally were handheld holding the camera to kind of give you that unsteady feeling. The very end, excuse me, the kind of false ending. I have bullet points that are very like hastily done, and then Leisha's got her dissertations every time. The very end shot when the Joker is in the car and it just got slammed by the ambulance. One of the rioters gets out, and it's probably shot in like 30 frames per second maybe. So when you slow that down on like a 24 frames per second timeline, it gives you a very fairy dreamlike kind of slow motion. Not straight up slow motion, but just very dreamlike. And so he gets out and the camera's in the car and it just kind of follows him as he walks around. And I just really enjoyed that shot. And the clown mask is just like staring you down. Yes. The whole time. Oh, I really liked in the subway when they get off of the train and he's doing that creepy run shuffle and it's the tight shot of his face straight on as he's doing it. I really like that shot. That run was creepy.
You just like full body shivered in your chair as you recall. Oh, yeah. This.
This room's cold also. I'm freezing. I'm always cold. Those are kind of my notes on that.
Okay. We just did editing. Music and composing.
Ooh, so for those of you who don't know, the music was composed before the movie was shot. And knowing that, I knew that beforehand. I don't know if you knew that
before. I didn't, no.
So, yes, so Phillips went to the composer, whose name we can't pronounce because we're assholes.
Sorry, baby.
Had it composed, and they listened to it on set while they shot. And you can, I feel that you can feel that.
Absolutely.
You can feel that he was taking in the emotions of the music and going with that.
What I mean, that makes so much sense. Mm-hmm. My first note, music's a character in and of itself in this film. Mm-hmm. It controls the mood, fits Arthur's path and emotions. So obviously I have it wrong, and it's vice versa. It leads us dances. It gives us a peek into the actuality of his psyche. And kind of on the second watch, we have that discussion very briefly. When the music's upbeat, at least to me, it tells me not to trust it.
Like the motivational, happy song.
Yeah, it tells me don't trust what I'm seeing.
Yeah, yeah.
On reflection, so Smile is playing when he's imagining that he's done really well during his stand-up routine.
Yeah.
And he has a date with Sophie. So we know for sure the date doesn't happen. And let's be honest with each other, it's only fair to assume his stand-up routine was a complete fucking disaster. Mm. So that in and of itself, you know, it was bad enough for someone to share it with Murray Franklin to be shared on late night television. So kind of when there's that sad, melancholy, dramatic distortion of music, that to me is like, oh, what we're seeing is reality. Mm-hmm. And then when it is more upbeat, motivational, kind of pumped up kind of music, or just happy kind of music, it makes me think this is something that I should not be trusting with my eyes. I'm going to trust my ears.
I think there's also something to be said when there was a lack of sound as well. In addition to like the somber, more somber music.
Yeah.
Because I don't believe the talk show segment during its peak really had any.
Oh, I think that was just like focus on Joaquin.
Well, yeah. I feel like. Yeah. A side note or fun fact with the music, the script was written and then the music was composed and then the shots were shot.
Right.
Arthur's dance, like in the bathroom scene, was completely changed to match the music from what it was in the script. And I think probably for the better.
Yeah, absolutely. Everything. I had so many notes on the dancing that I've just been kind of skimming over in the fear of becoming repetitive, but mm-hmm. just every time he danced was either I loved it because it made me feel like I needed to look away.
Oh, yeah.
It was so hard for me to watch.
The dancing was based off of a character in an older movie. I'll have to find that. We can post that in the show notes.
That's interesting. Mm. Very interesting. And kind of just moving on there, our last thing, and I feel like we've been talking about this in and out. I was saying just now, we're just kind of on extras in things, in performances, but natural segue that I just over-explained to hell. The whole film's uncomfortable, which is something that I hate and simultaneously applaud. Because if I'm uncomfortable seeing what happens to Arthur and around Arthur, then does that mean that I'm one of the people around him who are judging him? Am I empathizing with him? Or does it make me Arthur in the audience? Just that constant feeling of discomfort and not wanting to be there. I mean, you saw me. I have this really weird tendency. When I'm watching movies and get uncomfortable, I get really bad secondhand embarrassment, like secondhand mortification. I cover my ears. Like, I can watch as long as I can't hear what's happening. It's the most bizarre kind of signal mix-up. I found myself doing this a lot, especially on the first watch. But Arthur doesn't get to do that, so he doesn't get to escape. And with that, I empathize with. Also, I empathize with what he writes, which is the worst part of having a mental illness is people expect you to behave as if you don't. So everyone is different, status of mental illness or health aside. The feeling of being ostracized, I've gotten overexcited again, is something that almost everyone can empathize with. And I feel like that discomfort kind of signals to us that we need to be uncomfortable because Arthur's uncomfortable because everybody ostracizes Arthur. So I liked the how uncomfortable and just the secondhand embarrassment in this movie. His laugh too. Just his laughs were so uncomfortable.
So enamored and infatuated. Not infatuated, excuse me, just like obsessed with his laughter and the actor's process of trying to figure that out, which we mentioned a little bit of. And Todd, in an interview, I think along with Joaquin, said it wanted to be something that looked and felt painful. And I think that they achieved that.
Yeah.
Whole, especially with his like distressed laugh.
Ooh, yes. I hate that. Just because that we there are three different ones, right?
Yeah, I think we have that in our kind of fun facts later on.
Well, I guess I would say that the laugh was my favorite part about Arthur. It was an easy insight into his legitimate emotions. So it was evident to me when he was faking it. And that was the most unsettling aspect of the character because, you know, does he have something like reactive attachment disorder from his early childhood and he just doesn't know how to relate to other people? Or is he truly such a sociopath that this is how he believes human beings genuinely laugh? Like when he's faking being amused by something, faking that laughter, it creeps me the fuck out. That is not how people laugh. It's so unnatural. Like, of course, there's the distressed laughter. I'll let you talk a little bit more in the fun facts about the different laughs, but it's the, oh, this should be funny to me. Like when they're joking around after Randall gives him the gun and they're joking around his coworkers, things like that. He has that unnatural, I'm laughing because Randall made a joke type of laugh. He turns to walk down a hallway and it just stops.
Which is something that I actually do all the time.
Straight faces it. And it's so chilling. And I just hate the fact, like, oh, this is what you've decided actual human beings laugh like? Okay. Like, it freaks me out.
Another note about the dancing is a thought that occurred to me is that it's another visual representation of him slowly transforming into the Joker. Because it's really kind of stiff and awkward, and then by the end when he's on the Murray Franklin show, he's like a professional dancer,
right?
So it's a weird
his evolution. Phenomenal.
Yeah,
everything that Joaquin Phoenix did in this role was phenomenal.
Yeah, you asked me whether or not he deserved the Golden Globe over Adam Driver, and the more I think about it, I definitely think that he did.
Yeah.
So
I know a lot of you listening, as we're kind of getting started with this, they know us. And back when I, long ago last week, when I still had a personal Facebook page, my current kind of enrapturement with celebrity is with Adam Driver, and we watched Marriage Story, which we'll probably end up doing an episode on so good.
Worthy.
So we'd seen Marriage Story. We hadn't yet seen Joker, and I was rooting super hard for Adam to win the Globe, and Joaquin got it, and I was just super salty. And I think it was because I was thinking, but Adam Driver was so brilliant. How did someone playing the Joker win this? And, you know, after seeing it, I'm like, every ounce of saltiness that I felt has dissipated. I mean, he owned it.
Yeah, he transformed.
Absolutely. I mean,
completely.
Physically, mentally. And
didn't come out bad because of it. Like right, some other actors,
he took care of himself. Just, he deserves every nomination that he gets and probably every win. And even though, like, on my personal level, I might be rooting for Driver, like, Joaquin, he would deserve the Oscar for this. No question about it. He was just phenomenal. I forgot who I was watching.
Oh, yeah, you do. I mean, he physically transforms. He lost, fun fact, he lost, like, 52 pounds for this role.
Yeah, and he's not a big dude. Mm-hmm. Like, 52 pounds is immense.
And so he's physically and mentally, you know, transforming into this and you do forget who you're watching.
Yeah. We both had the same thought, I feel, at the same time. And I think it's when he's playing around with the gun shirtless in his living room toward the beginning. Whoa. We kind of both looked at each other because you can see his ribs.
Yeah.
Either that or he was practicing for the Murray Franklin show.
Well, it's both kind of the
same thing. Whatever time that he was shirtless.
It's a couple times, but yeah.
We looked at each other at one point and we're like, one, damn, like, skinny. Two, we both had that moment of, oh, Christian.
Yeah.
Like Christian Bale. From
Memento and...
Not Memento. Oh, not... From The Mechanic?
Mechanic, yeah.
The Machinist.
Machinist.
Damn it. One of those movies. I think it's late at night. I think it is late for us right now. The Machinist, I think. But anyways, as far as performances go, I mean, Robert De Niro is Robert De Niro. It was fun to see him in this role. He does what he does. He shows up. He acts well. He graces the screen with being Robert De Niro and huzzah. I mean, is he ever not great?
That's kind of what you can say for everybody else. They're just not quite as big a star as he is.
Speaking of someone not being as big a star. Oh! I'm so excited. So last week, I got to just spew my love all over the place for Richard Jenkins in Cabin in the Woods. Papa Fisher, if you will, from 6 Feet Under. And this week, I get to be just super, super excited about Mama Fisher because Frances Conroy was Penny Fleck in this movie. And she's just, I love her. She's old enough to be my grandmother. I worship the ground she walks on. I get so excited and make the weirdest squealing noises whenever she pops up in anything random. She's always my favorite part of American Horror Story. And just seeing her in such a major hit film makes me endlessly filled with joy because she's just one of those actresses that's been in the business for a long time. And I will bring her up and nobody knows who she is.
Mm-hmm.
And that devastates me. So at least I can have the point of reference of, oh, yeah, you know, Joker, Arthur's mom in Joker. And someone might understand. I just think that she's just such an underrated actress.
She is, and it's almost the same issue. You get to see her a little more.
Mm-hmm.
She gets to kind of flex her range a little bit more, but she's so great. She's still, like,
I know,
underused in this.
This is a character study film.
I know
this is one of your things. But
oh, side note. Yeah. The asymmetrical Joker makeup was creepy and great.
That is a side note. I think we... I'm going through, like, my side notes. And we hit on most of them. We even had some organic discussion about the mental health representation, which I didn't want to take too many notes on because I knew that I could spiral. So
you could have like a whole series on it.
Oh, 100%. And that's just because that's how I make my living. And I don't like when mental health is portrayed inaccurately, even though I guess I can't say that this is an inaccurate portrayal because they never name what it is. Which you used the word lazy earlier. Diagnoses don't always have to be present. As weird as it sounds and as particular as I sound, I'm actually not a fan of the DSM and specific diagnoses. However, things to me need to make sense to feel realistic. Mm-hmm. And this portrayal just didn't. But yeah, my most important thing on here, the very end of my notes before we get on to kind of our favorite parts, least favorite parts, etc., is Arthur is a sociopath. Does he also have neurobiological issues and PTSD? Yep. However, he's also a fucking sociopath, the end. And that's where I'll leave.
Just kind of reiterating.
My discussion,
yeah. Yeah, we might be able to move on.
Okay, yeah, sorry. That's okay. All right. Jules, what was your favorite part of this film?
My favorite part was when he took everything out of the fridge and just got into the fridge. And you made the point, which I think on a subconscious level really realized. But he disappears.
Yeah.
he gets into that fridge and he's gone, and the camera lingers and kind of starts to shake a little bit. And it's just, I don't know. I don't know why I love that shot, because it's a static shot. It yeah. doesn't move. It's just him doing it and getting in. And it's just really good.
You were so enthralled.
I loved it.
You were like a kid at a candy store, just like buzzing with this energy because he crawled into the fridge.
I'm gonna find or turn it into a GIF.
Yeah. Oh, I'm sure it's got to be out there. My favorite part was the entire scene on the Murray Franklin show at the end. From that the time good. That he came out until the time that he left. The dialogue, just more than anything, Joaquin's performance, the engagement of the performers on screen, and just kind of seeing the culmination and the full transition of Arthur into Joker taking place was just, it was wonderfully tense. It was heartbreaking. It was chilling. It had the appropriate kind of shock value because they had built it up for us to expect almost that he would kill himself in the end. And he shot, you know, Franklin in the face, and it was just so, there it is. There's no going back from this. Yes. Yeah. And that was my favorite part because I feel like it was, you used the word unapologetic, so I will stick with that. It was unapologetic. Mm-hmm. I know what your least favorite part is, but please.
But the color palette was also a favorite part. But yeah, my least favorite was the tacked on ending. I feel like it should have ended with him on the top of the car in the middle of the rioters with Gotham on fire, and then you cut to this almost seemingly tacked on scene in Arkham Asylum that, like, to me didn't serve any purpose, or they should have done a little bit more with it.
Sure.
The final line that he gives me is irritating as shit. You wouldn't get it. Come on. Stop. It's almost like...
Your annoyance is palpable.
They were trying to allude to more, and it's just... I think it goes back to their open-endedness with so many things.
Right.
It's not necessarily lazy, but...
Why? Yeah, it really did annoy the hell out of you.
It did.
And I, upon first watch, didn't like that scene either, because I didn't really... There were a couple things I didn't grasp. On second watch, I think I would opt to keep it. Because one, the tight shot on his face as he's singing along to a song that's not playing, I think is a bit of the finest acting that I've seen.
Could have been incorporated into the other
scene. Sure, and you're not wrong. I think it's the overall idea of, yep, we've got him. Let's show you that we've got him. And let's show you that the fact that we've got him doesn't change the fact that Joker is an agent of chaos in Gotham.
And I get that. But, like, I don't know. I guess I don't like the way that it was presented.
Sure. And I'm not judging you for it. It's not my favorite part. But I think I just liked it more upon reflection. Because initially it really bothered me too.
Still bothers me.
I know it does. My least favorite part is really difficult. I can't really think of a scene that I felt was pointless or a scene that I thought should be cut. So that made it difficult for me. I think I'd have to go based on my least favorite action of Arthur's, and that was him smothering his mother with the pillow.
That's because it was Francis.
It's not. And I even questioned my intrinsic motivation for that. But the relationship with his mother was kind of like a well-written tether to his humanity. Like, if he cared for anyone, he cared for her. And I understand where his anger towards her would come from. I understand where his feeling of betrayal towards her would come from. She's not winning any Parent of the Year awards, regardless of if it's her fault or if it's an organic issue. But that was likely the point of the scene, is that she was his tether to his humanity, but it didn't settle right with me. I didn't see the kind of motivation spelled out clearly enough for his action to make sense. Well,
it's back to the disjointed acts, right, of violence.
That's true. How would you score this film? 1 to 10?
7.
Yeah, you settled with that.
Mm-hmm. There are so many awesome an enjoyable, like, visual storytelling element.
Yeah.
Despite its wacky plot, this movie does do some things really lovely.
You use the word wacky.
Wacky.
Who are you? I also went with a 7. And this was after me kind of pleading almost to be like, I need to give 2 different scores because I can't just score this film. So essentially, you know, my enjoyability of the film was probably hitting a 5.5 out of 6. Mm. Or out of 6, Jesus. A 5.5 to 6 out of 10. However, if I'm scoring it based on everything in regards to filmmaking, the performances, the editing, the cinematography, direction, you know, everything that we've just kind of dissected, I'd be saying more that it's a solid 8.5 to 9 because it's a gorgeously crafted film. So 7 is where I land as well overall because I can't go lower because of the craft and I can't go higher because I don't...
the craft.
No! No, because the Blu-ray is going to sit where it's sitting right now for a very long time before I decide to engage with it again.
I mean, yeah, it was also a hard watch.
Yes and no. Comparatively to some of the shit that I've enjoyed.
Well, yeah, this is true.
Yeah. Right. But, I mean, it was...
You weren't interested in watching it a second time.
I wasn't.
And that says something.
It really does. But a 7. It's not my favorite DC film or DC adjacent film, and it's also not my least favorite DC adjacent film.
Do you have favorite DC?
The Anything? Dark Knight, Nolan's Dark Knight.
Yeah, that's true. I forget about those and because they're good.
and I like Wonder Woman too.
Yeah,
and then I like this one, and then everything else can kind of go fuck itself.
All right.
Yeah, getting off base here. So share your fun facts that you found out. We will share our info, and we will release you from this hell that we've created too late at night without knowing how to speak properly.
Woo! Oh, so I'm doing all the fun facts. That's cool. Filming dates. It was shot between September 10th, 2018 and December 3rd, 2018. The filming locations were primarily in New York City and Jersey City. Martin Scorsese's Taxi Driver and The King of Comedy, along with 1970s character studies, were the big inspirations, with the comic book Batman the Killing Joke being used as the base for the premise, but is not very inspired by the comic, which I think everybody could kind of tell. And that was, right. I think, an issue for a lot of comic book fans, is that this wasn't a comic book movie, but I don't think that that was the point. Leo, what?
I was just thinking, like, essentially, is this like Phillips fan fiction of Joker's origin right? story? But continue.
Leonardo DiCaprio was almost Arthur.
Oh my God, what would this have been like with Leo?
I don't know, but he had already committed to Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, which was filming at the same time. Scorsese was also set to direct, but he was working on The Irishman. De Niro was also in The Irishman, but his roles for that movie were already completed. So he's literally like the only person that was able to come to the Joker.
Oh, could you imagine this having been Scorsese with DiCaprio? Holy shit.
It like, might have made sense.
Not that. No. Stop. That was a low blow. No. I mean.
Sorry, Phillips.
It necessarily wouldn't have been bad. It just would have been so different.
I'm okay with what we have.
Yeah, same. I'm glad it worked out the way that it did. It just, I'm going to be imagining what that would have been like.
Warner Brothers almost vetoed the R rating, which means that they would have had to clean it up and so it could be PG-13.
Oh, gross.
I'm pretty sure Phillips and Silver had to like talk to 2 different sets of executives at Warner Brothers to convince them to keep the R rating. This is the best fun fact. There are at least 3 different laughs the Joker does. The affliction laugh, the one of the guys laugh, And then the authentic joy laugh at the end.
So it must have been the one of the guys laugh that really freaked me out.
Yes. Yeah. That's the one where he's trying to fit in. Although the affliction laugh is also just distressing because he's also crying.
Oh, yeah. It's devastating. Mm-hmm. There's a huge part of me that wants to, like, hold him and comfort him.
Ew.
Until, that probably has to do with the fact that it's Joaquin and, you know, anyways. But no, in all reality, joking aside, like, there is a huge part of me that wants to reach out to this fictional character to help.
And I think that goes back to just, like, the situation that he's in.
Yes.
And your profession. But, I mean, I think the main point is the situation that he's in and needing to help those right. in need.
Yeah. I know. But Arthur done fucked up.
Mm-hmm.
He made his bed. He's going to lie in it now.
Hey, guess what? Huh. My tea's gone.
My tea is also gone. It's not even cold.
Mine got cold, but that's another story.
I think Jules is trying to wrap us up a little bit early before we share our socials.
No, it was a segue into the socials.
Oh, well, sorry. So you can hit us up on Facebook at facebook.com/screenteapodcast. You can hit us up on Twitter
at screenteapod.
Screenteapod, I like that. You can shoot us an email at thescreenteapodcast@gmail.com. And exciting announcement that I'll let Juliet share since she did all the work.
Oh, we have a website that's mostly working. And that is screenteapodcast.com.
Beautiful. Awesome. All right. We're both out of tea. We're not making sense, nor have we been for the last hour and a half that we've been recording. So we hope to, I almost said see you next week, which is a turn of phrase.
No, she's watching you.
Yes, I am. Every move you make. However,
I just face palmed.
She did. This is my cue to go. All right, folks, you have a good week, and we will. You ready to facepalm again? We will catch you on the flip side.
Goodbye.